in the context of really law enforcement abuse. Am I right in thinking that as a general rule, it is not legal for me to tape record my conversation with you without telling you? Is it, you know?
No, it depends on the state.
Ah, all right.
It depends on in some states you can, and some states you need both party, at least in terms of telephone calls. Okay. In some states you can do it without.
Yep.
One party has the right to consent. Yep.
Well, I know that when you make phone calls, you very often to sort of recording things, you often get this message saying that we are recording this in order to approve service, which I assume means I think they're legally obliged to tell you. But what I was thinking of was that if you wanted to have a campaign, if there was some recent example of police malfeasance and you had a campaign against it, you could propose a state statute saying that it was always legal to tape record a police officer without telling him. That would make certain forms of abuse by the police somewhat more costly and difficult.
I don't think it's illegal to tape record someone without telling.
You don't think it is, in general?
I think it would only be covered by court law, this concept of a reasonable expectation of privacy, not the criminal sense, where there are certain places where it would be tortious for you to be reported, like, say, somebody came into your house. It would be... You might have a cause of action if they were doing things with it and they've done it in your house. There's some privacy cases where people with
you always take the risk of the person you're talking to. So no matter how if a third party is different, that's where you get tortious interference. But when I'm talking to somebody, I'm taking the risk that this person is trustworthy enough that they're
Because the argument that is the argument in favor of the legal you just described is that after all he can hear you. So it's not like he's getting any secrets from you. And the only reason the recording matters is that it lets him prove to other people that you said what you actually said, and you shouldn't object to that, basically.
That's where rules of evidence come in for criminal law.
Yes.
There's nothing wrong with recording.
I see. So in rules of evidence, very good. Suppose I take this nice little gadget, and I leave it on after the class is over, and something then happens which ends up in a law case. Can I introduce the recording as evidence?
Under most circumstances,
I can. Yes, that's the further problem. But as far as the fact that whoever I was recording didn't know I was recording, doesn't keep it out as evidence. Just curious. All right. So anyway, but the general issue of how you prevent the abuse of the enforcement system, I think, is an interesting and important and hard one. So that, for example, one very tempting proposal is that when somebody is acquitted, since the legal system has imposed very large costs on him, he's been in jail for 6 months, he had to pay for a lawyer, that therefore the part of the legal system that charged him in the first place should owe him large damages. But of course, what's the obvious problem with that rule? It's one obvious problem, there's more than one. But it might also reduce the number of acquittals of innocent people, because it would mean that if you did charge somebody, you would have an even stronger incentive than you now do to make sure he got convicted.
Yeah.
Notice incidentally that a different argument against it is that acquittal doesn't really mean you're innocent. Right? Legally we say you're innocent. Acquittal really means we couldn't prove you did it.
Right.
So you could imagine a legal system which followed the Scottish pattern, in which there are three verdicts: guilty and not proven and innocent.
There's sort of, in California, you're not acquitted unless it's 12-0 not guilty.
It's a hung jury, you mean, in particular.
Right, so there is, to some degree, that sense.
But in theory, at least, that non-guilty doesn't mean that 12 people are sure you didn't do it.
Right.
It means that 12 people aren't sure you did do it.
Right.
Now, in practice, I don't know if that really happens, but that's at least the theory of it. So, in a sense, any system where you try to penalize people for convicting innocent people has the disadvantage that it then makes it harder to prove that they convicted innocent people, because they have a strong incentive to stop you. And, of course, that's true already, that I gather that when people have, you know, DNA projects and such, depending on where you are, it's often hard to get permission from the police prosecutor people to do the tests, because presumably they are afraid that it might turn out they convicted somebody who was innocent, and that'll make them look bad. Making them legally liable would be a more extreme version of that.
Yeah.
So that covers the criminal law stuff I wanted to review. Are there any questions on that before we do the beginning of antitrust? No? Yes? All right. So what I want to discuss in the antitrust context basically is three different questions. The first is, what's wrong with monopoly? Why is it a problem at all that we want to have laws to control? Second is, why does it exist? And I'm going to suggest that you can usefully imagine four categories of monopoly. One of them was the original meaning, namely a monopoly privilege granted by the state. Another is a natural monopoly, a case where a single large firm can produce more cheaply than any smaller firm and therefore ends up holding the whole market. Third is the artificial monopoly, which is what many people believe, though I think the evidence is mistakenly, that Standard Oil was, that is, a company which gets its monopoly by undercutting competitors even though it's got its costs of production are no lower than theirs. And finally, a cartel, which is an artificial monopoly in a different sense, that it's a group of firms, a small number of firms typically, who get together and coordinate their behavior as if they were a single firm to get monopoly profits. And then the final question is, what do you do? What might the legal system do about monopoly? And one thing that depends on is why the monopoly exists. That after all, if the monopoly is a state monopoly, the easiest thing to do about it is to repeal whatever law says nobody else can do whatever they're doing. But also, if you look at behavior which antitrust law has sometimes tried to regulate, one of the interesting questions is, why does this behavior exist? So that a pattern that you're going to see three times, actually, because these are sort of three classic examples, is, here is a pattern of behavior. Here is a traditional legal explanation of why it happens. Here is why that explanation is wrong. That is why, not why it's not bad, but why it wouldn't be profitable for the firm to do it for the reason that the law assumes it would be doing. All right, since we do observe the behavior, why does it happen? And then if that's why it happens, is it good or bad? So that's sort of a somewhat involved sequence of analysis that we'll be going through. Sorry, I haven't. Just leave me again. So in a sense, to answer the question, what's wrong with monopoly, the previous question is, what's right with the alternative? In what sense does a competitive market with lots of firms do the right thing? And the full explanation is too lengthy for our purposes. But this one. What?
Some profit better than no profit?
I don't think I understand.
Assuming that there are two companies, unless they price equally, pricing down less will get one company a higher percentage of the available profit on the market than the other company.
Why would anybody buy from them if they're charging a higher price?
Right, so the other, that's what I'm saying. So if there's two companies that are both selling the same product, they could, if they're not both willing to charge the exact same price and one of them charges a slightly less price, then a large percent of the market share is going to go to the lower price.
That's right.
Thereby causing the other company to do the same thing until they arrive at a price cost.
That's
even though they both could have made a lot more money had they priced the same.
But with two firms, that probably doesn't work very well, because with two firms, the heads of the two firms go out to lunch with each other.
Right.
But with 100 firms, now the argument becomes that you're going to tend to drive prices down to the cost of producing one more unit, to marginal cost. And it turns out, for reasons that you may have seen in a microeconomics course, but I'm not going to go through it now, that in the competitive market, you end up with marginal cost equal average cost for slightly complicated reasons. So the firms are exactly covering their costs in total, and they're exactly covering the cost on the last unit they sell, and that's the price. And then the argument is that having a price equal to marginal cost is the economically efficient rule, because it means that each consumer decides whether to buy something or not according to whether its value is more or less than the price. And that means that if it costs $40 to make something and it's worth $41 to me, you make it and I buy it. if it costs $40 to make something and it's worth $39 to me, you don't make it and I don't buy it, and that's the right answer, that we make those things that are worth at least as much as they cost. And furthermore, it also has the result that each thing that's made goes to the person who values it most, because he's the one willing to pay the highest price. Again, remembering that we're interested often not in the value for having all of it, but the value of having the last unit that you're buying. So if we imagine a society where some people are much richer than others, the result is not that all the water goes to the rich people. It's that the rich people buy water to drink, flush their toilets, and water their lawns with. The medium people buy water to drink and flush their toilets with, and the poor people buy water to drink. And at that point, the last gallon is worth the same amount to all those three people, less to the rich person due to the fact that he's using it for a less important purpose, but more to the rich person because the dollars that his value is measured in are worth less to him, and therefore he's willing to pay more for a given thing. All right, so same argument, if you carry it through, says that when the firm decides how to produce things, it's minimizing its dollar cost of inputs. But since each input, again, assuming it's a competitive market all the way through, each input is being priced at its cost of production, that also means the firm is minimizing the human cost. That if it buys an extra hour of your labor, it's pricing that at what it has to pay you to be willing to work an extra hour. If it's buying an extra bushel of apples to make applesauce, it's got to be paying at least as much as the people who'd like to eat those apples value them at. So in effect, via the price system, all of the human costs are passed through to the people in the form of money costs, and thus you get a firm producing in the way that has minimum human costs. Again, remembering that it's in all of the economic efficiency stuff, human costs are measured in dollars, not in units of happiness, and therefore an hour to a rich person counts as a bigger cost than an hour to a poor person. All right. Basic argument, which I've run through here and some of you have seen before. So what's wrong with monopoly? And what's wrong with monopoly is it doesn't act that way. You can read this. I'll rest my voice for a moment. Competitive market, the firm says, what happens if I sell one more unit? I get the price of that unit. On a monopoly market, the monopoly says, what happens if I want to sell one more unit a year? I'm going to have to get a little bit less money for everything, because to get people to buy more, I have to sell a slightly lower price. Therefore, I get the price I sell it for, I lose whatever I lose on everything else, and therefore, my net return is less than the price I sell it for, and therefore, if the price was just the marginal cost, I'd be losing money each time I sold a unit. So therefore, the optimal price is somewhere higher than marginal cost. You can do a more exact analysis, but I don't think we need to for our purposes. So the fact that a monopoly is selling at price marginal, greater than marginal cost, means from the standpoint of the individual consumer, that even if the value to the good is more than it costs to produce it, it may be less than the price, and he therefore doesn't get it. And we're therefore missing an opportunity to produce something that cost you $10 to produce and is worth $12 to me. That's a net loss. Further one, which I don't mention in this slide, if you imagine that the monopoly is not selling to consumers but to other producers, those producers, in deciding what inputs to use, are going to take the price of the input as the measure of its cost rather than the actual cost of producing it. So if we imagine that steel is produced by a monopoly, turn it around actually, suppose aluminum was produced by a monopoly, as for a while it was, and steel is produced in a competitive market, and I am trying to decide whether to use steel or aluminum for making the body of my cars, say, I'm going to take the price of the two as measuring the relevant cost, and so I say, all right, since steel costs $100 a ton and aluminum costs $200 a ton, I should only use aluminum if basically two, it takes 2 tons of steel to do what 1 ton of aluminum does. But maybe, perhaps the real cost of producing aluminum is the same as steel per ton. It's just that the aluminum monopoly has the price higher than that. So therefore, the efficient decision would be to make the trade-off at 1-to-1. And it's not going to be in my interest to do that. So therefore, I'll be producing cars with less aluminum and more steel than would be the actual lowest cost way of producing it. Does that make sense? So therefore, the existence of the monopoly, as it were, propagates an inefficiency, a sort of a false signal through the system. A further problem, again, as far as I know, first pointed out in print by Tulloch, is that if there is going to be a monopoly, if we see a situation where at some future time there will be an industry with room for only one firm, it pays me to try to make sure I'm that monopoly, even if doing so requires me losing money for a while so that I'm the first guy in that industry. I don't remember if I ran through my example of the railroad running into a valley when I was talking about rent-seeking before, but that's sort of the one where I imagine that there's a valley which has settlement moves west will eventually be profitable to farm, and there's going to be a railroad line eventually down that valley, and the railroad line will make $10 million monopoly profit over the length of time it exists. But there's only room for one railroad line, so whoever builds first is going to get that profit, so it pays to build inefficiently early in order to get the jump on the people who would have built later. So you have a problem dissipating the monopoly profit in expenditures to become the monopolist, just like you've got the problem of dissipating the profit from theft by expenditures to be the thief. There's a further problem which I think often tends to get left out of the econ textbooks, but is relevant, and that is that one condition for efficient production is that every consumer who values the good at least its cost of production gets it, and only those consumers. But the second condition, remembering that the cost of production is the marginal cost, the cost of the last unit, as it were, is that the good is only produced if the total value to all the people who get it is at least as great as the total cost of producing it. That you could imagine a case, take my computer program case, the marginal cost is very low, $1 to burn a package of CD. Writing the program costs $10 million worth of programmer's time. If you sell it at marginal cost, you sell 10,000 of them. You're certainly not covering your costs. But furthermore, you don't even know if it ought to exist, because you'd have to know how much more than $10 was actually worth to your customers to figure out if their net gain more than one, whenever. Suppose that at $10 nobody would buy any, so you know the value to the customer of the program is who buys it. The program, if the customer buys it at $1, the value is between $1 and $10. And at $1, you sell 10,000. So the total benefit to the customers of buying at $1 is at the very most $90,000. If we assume that every customer valued it at $10, which is the most they could value, because when you get up to 10, nobody buys it, so $9.99, then the total gain to the customers of buying it at $1 is at most $8.99 each. Multiply that by 10,000 customers, and you have just under $90,000, but it cost you $10 million to write the program. So even if you were thinking, not do I make a profit, but should this exist, the answer is no, it shouldn't exist. So ideally, we would like to somehow set up our world or our laws or our markets or whatever in such a way both that everybody who values the product at marginal cost gets it, and that the product is only produced if the total value to all the people who get it is at least as large as the total cost. All right? Trying to make that total versus marginal distinction, which is important in economics but not very intuitive. All right. Let's now take a break from the question of why is monopoly bad and ask why is monopoly. And I want to run through these four cases. So I think the original usage of the meaning of the word was a monopoly privilege given by the ruler, so that one way of raising tax money was to say, we're only going to let one person sell salt in France. How much will you pay to be that person, that firm? And there are a fair number of examples in the modern world. The post office is nominally private, but the so-called, what are they called, the something express statute, public express, not quite right, something express statutes, which go back, I think, to the 19th century, basically say that it is illegal for anybody else to carry first-class mail for profit, maybe mail for profit. And my understanding is that UPS and FedEx legally are package delivery companies and found some loophole big enough to fit what they're doing. But if they were doing something that was unambiguously first-class mail, the post office could sue them and close them down. And there was a 19th century case of an entrepreneur who did that and did get shut down. The story, as I heard it, I'm not sure if it's true, is that the point at which he got shut down was when he sent in a bid to the federal government to carry their mail for half what the post office was charging. The man's name was Lysander Spooner, and he was quite an interesting character. He was an anarchist of his own odd sort. Wrote a wonderful essay called No Treason, the Constitution of No Authority, in which he asks, why are we obliged to obey this Constitution anyway? Did you sign it? I didn't sign it. Who signed it? A bunch of people who claimed they had authority to sign it for us, even though we didn't exist yet. And he goes on and sort of, anyway, it's a fun essay, if you sort of imagine dropping all of the usual unstated assumptions about the legitimacy of the system, and then concluding that it's basically the government's a gang of robbers. The other examples that have been fairly important, still are important, are regulated industries where the government in various ways controls entry and price. And prior to deregulation of the airlines, you could not start a new airline without Civil Aeronautics Board permission, a new interstate airline, I should say. You could not fly a route you already were not already authorized to fly interstate without government permission. And you could neither raise nor lower your rates without CAB permission. And of course, if you wanted to cut your rates or to fly a new route, you could expect the other airlines to go to the CAB and say, no, we can't afford a destructive rate war, and there's enough service on this route already, we don't want another competitor on this route, and so forth. Similar story with trucking regulation. Lots of smaller scale examples. I think in most cities, most large cities, barbers require a license, which requires some hundreds of hours of classroom stuff on how to cut hair. Taxi cabs in, I think, all U.S. cities, though I'm not sure. Certainly in the big cities, New York's a famous example. The medallion, which gives you permission to operate a taxi cab, sells for like 5 or 10 times what the taxi cab sells for. Several hundred thousand dollars when I last knew it. Some of these examples, the regulator controls price and other things. Some of them, like the barbers, I think they don't control price. They just control entry to the profession. So in any case, government-sanctioned monopoly is, in fact, a very common pattern. Natural monopoly is also a very common pattern, although my guess is that most of the natural monopolies are small, not big, that the sort of classic case one imagines is where the economies of scale, the ability to produce more cheaply and reduce more, keep going to the point where one big firm can just undersell anybody else, and so it's a monopoly. And I think the reason that doesn't usually happen is that there are diseconomies of scale for administrative reasons, that basically the farther the owner is from the factory floor, the harder it is for him to make sure everybody's doing the right thing, and the more people he has to hire in between to monitor. That therefore the normal pattern is that as size goes up, costs fall and then start going up again. And the natural monopoly occurs in the situation where the total size of the market is such that before they start going up again, you've already sold unless people want to buy, essentially. That's sort of the classic natural monopoly situation. And as I said, that could be a very large firm in an industry with a lot of economies of scale, but it could also be the only general store in a small town. It could also be me. That I presume that there are some people out there who like my nonfiction books, for example. Hence, I'm not in a competitive market where if my book sells for 10 cents more than somebody else, if my book sells for 10 cents more than Posner's book on law and econ, the result will not be that everybody buys him and nobody buys mine. Nor if mine sells for 10 cents less, will I get all of his market. So that in that sense, because of differing characteristics of the good, I'm in a sense a natural monopolist. And same thing as a public speaker, same thing as lots and lots of, think of your favorite mystery novelist, if you read mysteries. So, now there's a further case called monopolistic competition, which may describe that even better, but I don't think I'm going to get into that here. So, in all of these are logically monopolies. If I think about what I ought to charge to give a talk, say, I don't say what is the lowest price at which I'd be willing to give the talk, because I know that there aren't a whole bunch of other people who are perfect substitutes for me who will undercut me if I don't. And in principle, I try to say, if I could, what's the most this particular employer will pay me for a talk? I offer to give the talk for a dollar less than that. Not quite that good at it, unfortunately. Cartel case starts out as the almost natural monopoly. So if we imagine that the market is big enough to support five firms, and a firm bigger than that would have no efficiency advantages, but not 50, now there's the obvious possibility of the five firms getting together, that's my two people having lunch together, and saying, look, this destructive competition is ruining the industry and it's bad for the country, and you know, all sorts of things. What will happen to the yacht industry if we can't make any money for ourselves? So therefore, wouldn't it be nice? I think it would be a good thing for the industry if we all cut back our production a little bit, let prices go where they will. And in some contexts, that's an explicit agreement. That is, there have been legal regimes where such contracts were legal. In the U.S., they're not only unenforceable but illegal, but it doesn't mean they'll never happen. So I want to suggest that there are at least three problems for a cartel before any of you try to organize one. You want to at least think about these. One of them is that given the cartel agreement, which is pushing price above cost of production, it's in each firm's interest to cheat on that agreement, what's referred to as chiseling. And I've got a quote somewhere from John D. Rockefeller. And this is really, it's not about Standard Oil. It was about an attempt to cartelize the production of oil out of the ground. Standard Oil was a refining company, but he was, of course, involved in the whole industry. And a bunch of producers, I think it was in Pennsylvania, I'm not sure, early on in the history of the industry, made an agreement which they'd all keep their output down to get prices up. And the quote is something like that, these men, many of them honorable men of the highest standing. Nonetheless, it was very hard to keep oil from, to keep each of them from producing more oil than he said he was going to. And that as long as oil comes out of the ground, you know, this problem will exist. So one solution to that is an enforceable contract, if it's legal, to say, all right, if we discover you've been selling below the agreed on price, we can sue you for damages. Or a fairly common way of doing it where it's legal is that all of the firms in the cartel sell through a common selling agency. And so that can control the price we sell, and we have some rule on how much of the market each of us gets. Second possibility is you get the government to regulate your industry and have them enforce the cartel. That's the railroad airline situation, trucking. Another in principle is you watch each other carefully enough so that as soon as anybody starts cutting prices, everybody else knows that they cut prices, and so you don't cut prices in the first place. But then perhaps the most interesting, if you want a sort of employment as lawyers, is to figure out legal contracts that will de facto be cartel contracts. And we're out of time, and I think I discuss it in the book, though I'm not sure, but whether I discuss it in the book or not, I simply put to you the project. Your employer says, look, I and these four other firms in the industry would like a way of preventing destructive competition. Can you think of any legal arrangements we could make which are on their face not anti-competitive, not illegal, but will have the result of making the interest of each of us to cut back his output and thus all of us to make more money? And I'll let you think about that puzzle since we're now running out of time. that I have an answer, which I think is even legal as long as we're not too obvious about it, but we can discuss that.
Somebody discussion, because I think that it depends on where it is. I think my classmates were actually in error on this one, because from what I understand from tort law, there's something called the reasonable expectation of privacy. If you try to record me in my own house.
Is this recording when I am or I'm not present? Because it's not clear to me that that a conversation between me and you have an expectation of privacy, since you know that I'm there listening.
Well, but for example, if I'm talking to you in the privacy of my own house, I think it's more tied to the location. I have a reasonable expectation that this is my house and not a public place. If you were talking to me in a hallway of a restaurant or someplace.
Yeah. I simply don't know. You may be correct. The counter argument would be that it isn't violating your privacy because you know I'm there, and therefore you know I'm hearing, and that all the recording does is let me prove it to other people what you said. And that's not exactly a privacy issue. Maybe it is.
Well, maybe the idea that people say things that they naturally want to keep confidential. I mean, mm-hmm. I could make one example that I think would be very salient is somebody recording a conversation between an attorney and his client, which
yes.
would seem to my mind clearly be illegal because
yes.
of confidential relationship.
But wait a minute, for the attorney to record it is illegal?